We're kind of
well, good morning. I'm calling to order this meeting of the House Committee on Children and Families Finance and Finance and Policy. I was the one being loud there. And welcome to everybody. So glad to have you all with us. We're going to start, as usual, by having the clerk take the roll. Ms. Kahn, if you could please do that.
Chair Pinto?
Present.
Vice Chair Keeler?
Present.
Lee Daniels?
Present.
Representative Bliss?
Present.
Representative Coulter?
Present.
Representative Davis? Representative Hansen?
Present.
Representative Hemmingson-Yeager?
Present.
Representative Hicks?
Present.
Representative Hudson?
Present.
Representative Katiza-Watoon?
Present.
Representative Lee?
Present.
Representative Nelson? Representative Perez-Vega?
Present.
Representative Zalesnikar?
Here.
We have a quorum.
Excellent. We do have a quorum. And so next item of business is our minutes. And I'll ask Vice Chair Keeler, if she can, to move approval of the minutes of January, our meeting of January 31.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I've reviewed the minutes and move for approval.
Thank you. And so any additions or corrections to those minutes of January 31, members? For hearing none, all in favor of approval of the January 31 minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Okay. So we have our minutes approved. Thank you. And then, so members, a couple items up today. The first one is House File 2, and I'll ask Representative Richardson to head up to the testifier table. This bill relates to establishing a plan for paid family medical leave. And members, it's as was in the hearing notice, it's in our committee because of just a limited part of the bill, Article 2, which starts, well, it's towards the end. I'll see if I can provide that. I think right page 60. 65, and of course, and then the impact on kids and families, which I think would be significant from this, and so we'll hear that. But so we do have limited time and that limited scope. I will ask Vice Chair Keeler to move the House File 2 be referred to the committee on, I believe it's on labor. Well, I guess we can amend that if necessary, but is that your motion, Vice Chair Keeler?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Thank you so much. Representative Richardson, hopefully you'll correct me if that was in your knowledge as opposed to go elsewhere, land, labor, and industry. And so welcome to you, Representative Richardson. Your bill is before us, and please begin your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think there was a small technical amendment as
well. An excellent point, yeah. And I think this is just correcting a typo, essentially, or an incorrect reference is all. And so this is the 2-2. I'm sorry, one moment, hold on. Oh, here we go, yeah, the A-12 amendment. And so this is an author's amendment. Vice Chair Keeler, if you're willing to move the A-12.
So moved.
Thank you. Any conversation about that? Pretty simple. So hearing none, all in favor of approval of the A-12 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Okay. Thank you, Representative Richardson. And so we have HF2 before us with that tiny amendment. And so please begin your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 2 would establish a state paid family and medical leave program. The United States currently ranks last among high wealth nations for paid leave. According to the Minnesota Department of Health, between 2016 and 2020, 77%, the vast majority of mothers, worked during their pregnancy, and nearly two-thirds of Minnesota mothers took unpaid leave after giving birth. What we have nationally and here in Minnesota is an uneven safety net with significant gaps. That means most of Minnesota's families are falling through the cracks. And this disproportionately impacts low-income families, families of color, and rural families who are least likely to have access to paid leave. Our current system means that many of our most vulnerable new parents have the least access for opportunities to rest and recover. The research is clear. Access to paid leave contributes to healthy development of little ones and improves outcomes for families. Access to paid leave reduces infant mortality. And make no mistake, there are significant costs as a state we are bearing without access to paid family leave, as an estimated 350 infants die annually in the state. Access to paid leave also reduces low birth weight babies and preterm births. The Minnesota Task Force on Prematurity found an estimated annual cost of $371 million in terms of cost of care for just the first year of life for preterm babies. That figure did not include indirect costs to parents and caregivers, such as time away from work or emotional stress. I would also argue that these costs are even higher today, as those numbers are from several years ago. The cost of hospitalization for immaturity or respiratory distress averages nearly $70,000. Furthermore, 32.6% of the infant deaths in the state are related to preterm births. Access to paid leave provides additional health benefits related to immunization rates and ensuring timely well-child checkups. It also increases breastfeeding duration, which strengthens an infant's immune system, stimulates positive brain development, and decreasing risk of infections, respiratory illness, diabetes, reduced hospitalizations, and sudden infant death syndrome. It reduces postpartum depression that can interfere with bonding and improve mental health. And it also reduces reliance on public assistance and increases female participation in the labor force. Women who return to work after taking paid leave are about 40% less likely to receive public assistance in the year after giving birth than women who keep working and have no leave at all. The reality is, most child care centers will not accept infants until they are 6 weeks old, and this can really complicate decisions for families and often prevents individuals from returning to paid work. The time following childbirth or adoption is a key opportunity to bond, a time to recover from delivery, and a time to set a solid foundation for your little one to achieve their full potential, as that rapid brain development during early childhood makes it easier for children to learn about the world around them. Lack of access to paid family leave is hurting Minnesota families, and it doesn't have to be this way. I'd like to yield my time to Ms. Deborah Fitzpatrick, who will give a brief overview of Article 2, which is in the committee's jurisdiction.
Thank you so much, Representative Richardson, and welcome to the committee. So glad, I think this is your first time with us this year, Deborah Fitzpatrick. So good to have you. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Pinto, members of the committee. My name is Deborah Fitzpatrick. I'm the Director of Policy and Research at Children's Defense Fund Minnesota. In a prior role at the University of Minnesota, under contract with DEED, I led the nationally recognized research team that conducted Minnesota's legislatively mandated paid family and medical leave design and implementation study. As Representative Richardson mentioned, I'm going to just spend a few minutes summarizing the sections under committee jurisdiction in Article 2. So the Diversionary Work Program and the Minnesota Family Investment Program caregivers are required to spend a specified number of hours every week engaged in work or work activities. Examples of acceptable activities include job search activities, unsubsidized employment, and on-the-job training. Sections 1, 2, and 3, starting on line 65.14, remove this requirement while a participant is receiving paid family and medical leave benefits under the program in House File 2. A DWP or MFIP recipient would be unable to participate in work activities due to the underlying condition that qualified them for those paid family and medical leave benefits. The Minnesota Family Investment Program a grant is composed of a cash portion and a food portion. Benefits depend upon income. Income is defined as earned and unearned. Earned income is income that results from work, effort, or labor, and unearned income is a payment a family member did not expend individual effort to or labor to receive. So starting on line 67.20, we define paid family and medical leave wage replacement benefits as earned income, meaning it counts the same as it would if the person received the income from wages. Again, the rationale here is that paid family medical leave wage replacement is earned based on past work, effort, or labor. This means the recipient would be able to continue to receive food and cash benefits, cash portion of their benefits, again, while they're on leave. So I'll stop there and be available for questions.
Yeah, I might ask, Ms. Fitzpatrick, in order to understand Article 2, I think it'll be helpful. Can you just step back and give a sense of the structure of what the program is overall? Article 2 is within our jurisdiction, but I think it does make sense to understand that. You need to understand the basics of the plan as a whole.
Yes. Yeah, so, House File 2 creates a publicly administered publicly administered insurance program that is funded over the long term with contributions from both employers and workers. It allows self-employed and independent contractors to opt into the program, and it also allows employers to offer a comparable benefit. Eligibility for the program is based on earnings during the past year, earnings level that's similar to eligibility for the unemployment insurance system, and also a health care provider's certification under most cases for a serious health condition or a family member serious health condition. In the case of bonding, there are other forms of certification that are required.
When you say bonding, you're not talking about investments in roads and bridges, you're talking about.
Right, excuse me. In this context,
baby we're, adoption.
Exactly. So that's the placement of a child, either through a placement or a birth. Within 1 year after the birth or a placement of a child. So the other thing that I wanted to mention is that the infrastructure, a lot of the program is designed to build on the unemployment insurance system processes, successful UI processes, as well as those in 12 other states, or 11 other states in the District of Columbia that have already adopted these programs. So we are able to learn from those programs. The program provides up to 12 weeks of leave for a medical condition and up to 12 weeks for family leave. However, it's really important to acknowledge that we have a lot of data, both from decades of the FMLA survey, other surveys done by the U.S. Department of Labor on leave-taking behavior, as well as the experiences of these other 11 states, that show that the vast majority of people are using way less than the entitlement that they have, the maximum entitlement for leave that they have, and the vast majority are only using one type of leave in any given year. And those that are using two types of leave, it is, again, the vast majority of those are for a pregnancy-related leave followed by a bonding leave.
Thank you. That's helpful. What I'm inclined to do is we've got a few folks signed up to testify. We'll go through those. But I think I'm inclined to keep questions until the end, and then we'll have folks be able to ask you that. So thank you so much. And so I'll call up the first testifier, which is Amy Schultz. And if you can please identify yourself. And for these folks, we'll be asking you to, and hopefully this communicated to you in advance, to keep the testimony pretty short, just a minute or two. Or maybe a little bit over that, but so Amy Schultz, please identify yourself. Welcome and proceed.
Thank you. My name is Amy Schultz. Thank you so much, committee and chair. Yes, my name is Amy K. Schultz. I'm a self-employed adjunct professor and author. I'm a leader with Isaiah, and I live in Minneapolis. Paid family medical leave is essential for Minnesota families. When I was pregnant with my first child, I applied for short-term disability through my employer, but was denied because I had a pre-existing condition, migraines. My employer gave me 12 weeks of unpaid medical leave, so we only had one income. I was on bed rest, and my daughter was premature with jaundice. Along with postpartum depression, I got an infection the first week after she was born. I also had major surgery to remove my gallbladder 6 weeks later. It was a challenge for us. I'm not alone in my experience. As a former FMLA coordinator for a company with several thousand employees, I was always stunned to talk to mothers who couldn't afford to take much time off from medical leave after having a child. Usually, these were single moms. They didn't have a choice. As a self-employed worker today, I have no safety net if I have to take time off to care for myself or a family member. If a major medical emergency happened, it could send me into poverty. Paid family medical leave. Families will not worry about their next meal and how to pay bills. paid family and medical leave. Dads and moms can lovingly bond with their newborns. Paid family and medical leave will get the newest Minnesotans off in a stronger, safer, healthier direction. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thanks for sharing your experience. We've got Vanessa Bradby up next.
Yeah, thanks.
Good morning.
By yourself, yeah, proceed.
Hi, I am Reverend Vanessa Bradby. Thank you very much. I am the pastor at New Spirit United Church of Christ in Savage, Minnesota, and I'm also an Isaiah clergy leader. But I'm also here speaking as a mother today to voice my support for the paid family medical leave. I have three children, and when my youngest was just 6 months old, we started an intensive diagnosis process for my two older children for autism and ADHD, and they were 3 and 5 at the time. Now, between different practitioners and school conferences and therapies and evaluations and figuring out how to get all of it covered by insurance, there were weeks where that was like a full-time job for me. And that meant that if I wanted my children to get the care that they needed, then I could not have another job, essentially. And because, I mean, I would say mostly because I knew I couldn't get enough time off to take care of my children in the way that they needed at that time. So at that time, my family had to rely on my husband's income. And I ended up putting off my own education and my own professional development for years. And now looking back at that time, though, the thing that I think about, especially given what's happened in the world in the past 2 years, is what would have happened if my husband had gotten seriously ill? Or what would have happened if he had lost his job and he couldn't work at that time? And what happens to families who can't survive on one income in the first place? I know we were fortunate then. Because if I was the only one doing that, I know that it would have been impossible to access the kind of care that I was able to access because I had that time and that ability. And my story is just one of many as well. 70% of families who have a child with a disability, an intellectual or developmental disability, they report that caregiving has interfered with work. Some of them have to choose not to work like I did. And other families have to cut their hours or turn down a better position because it wouldn't allow them to take care of their kids. So this just, I mean, this breaks my heart for them. And too many families are also heartbroken by having to make these tough choices. So the bottom line, I think, should be that no family should have to choose between a paycheck and caring for their loved ones. And I think we have a unique opportunity here in this moment to really live up to our values of caring for one another. And if we're serious about loving our neighbor, then we should be serious about passing this paid family medical leave bill. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Pastor. Thanks for sharing your experience. Margot Zarin-Pass is up next. Pronouncing your last name correctly. And please identify yourself and share what you have to say.
Good morning. Thank you, Chair Pinto and Committee. My name is Dr. Margot Zarin-Pass. I'm a pediatrician and a representative, or I'm sorry, I'm not a representative. I'm a resident of District 60A. I already have a great representative. Thank you for allowing me to testify today. I'd like you to please imagine with me walking down a hospital hallway and knocking on a patient room door. Entering, and inside the lights are off, there's a white noise machine going, there's a wall of medical equipment, an empty couch, an empty rocking chair, and in the crib is a two-month-old baby who's swaddled and has a feeding tube in their nose, all alone. And this baby has been here for weeks, recovering from emergency abdominal surgery. Their parents were able to take a few days off right around the surgery. But now they're both back at work, and they desperately need to keep their jobs to be able to keep their insurance and be able to pay their bills, not least of which this child's bills. This is not a hyperbolic example. This happens multiple times a day, every day, when I'm in the hospital. Sick children are commonly left alone because their loving guardians have to be at work. It's also not just an emotional story. It's practical. Scared toddlers in the hospital don't sleep. Frightened 7-year-olds refuse blood draws. We are able to do our jobs better, get kids healthier, faster, and home sooner when they have a loving guardian with them. Every child deserves to have a loving adult guardian with them, and it should not depend on their job. So thank you again, and thank you, Representative Richardson, for this essential bill.
Representative Pest, thank you. And thanks for helpful describing for me the impact of kids and families on this bill that I will admit I had not thought in those terms. Dr. Abubakar, if you can come up. And once you settle in, we'll be asking you to identify yourself and proceed with your testimony. Please.
Good morning, Chair Pinto and members of the committee. I'm Dr. Abiola Abubakar. I work as an advanced practice public health nurse, a healthcare innovation consultant, and I'm the co-founder of ABEA Collective, where I work as a prenatal and postpartum doula. ABEA Collective is a birth and postpartum collective focused on promoting the well-being of birthing people during their pregnancy and childbirth experience by empowering them to build a community that reflects the values that are most important to share with their child. At ABEA Collective, we acknowledge that there are many variables that factor into one's perinatal experience, which is why I'm here today on behalf of the Prenatal to Three Coalition in support of House File 2, Paid Family Medical Leave. Paid family medical leave is necessary to support Minnesota's families and their abilities to care for Minnesota's future, our children. From my experience as an advanced practice public health nurse working across the 7-county metro area to my experience as a doula, I cannot overstate the value of this benefit on the lives of Minnesotans across our state, from here in the metro up to Red Lake and everywhere in between. Paid family medical leave programs supported by public investments have proven to increase health outcomes during the perinatal process for both parents and children by reducing stress, which can in turn decrease birth complications, and supporting parents' mental health while caring for their child or children. Access to paid family and medical leave during the perinatal process supports parents during the postpartum period as well. Huge milestones take place during this period, many of which are integral to healthy childhood development, such as breast or chest feeding. Feeding rates are increased significantly when families have access to the supports, and also bonding and secure attachment. Paid family leave provides parents with time to spend with their newborns and newly adopted children. This valuable time supports the development of secure bonds, which are the foundation for healthy development in the long run. Currently, access to these forms of care is not equitable. As studies have shown, rural communities, Black communities, Indigenous communities, and other marginalized communities are less likely to have access to paid family and medical leave. House File 2 ensures all families have the opportunity to build strong bonds with their newborns and newly adopted children by making sure no parent has to make the heart-wrenching decision to choose between financial devastation and being a present and attentive parent. I urge you to help Minnesota families by ensuring that no part of the perinatal period has to be synonymous with the word struggle.
Doctor, thank you so much, and thanks for your really important work. Thank you. Are there any members of the public here who wish to testify? Ask that question. Not seeing any. Okay, so we can turn to member discussion and questions. There we go. Representative Hudson, we'll start with you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to do my best to respect the constraints that you're trying to operate under here in limiting conversation to the jurisdiction of this committee on Article 2. So there are a number of questions that I could ask that I will save for another time.
Thank you, sir.
But I do want to ask about the impact on child care providers and their employees when it comes to the payroll tax that is going to be created to fund the benefit payments resulting from this program. Lines 5229 through 5233 describe the process for collection of overpayments, and they state that the commissioner has the discretion regarding whether to recover any overpayment for reasons other than misrepresentation. And the question that I have is, even if there was some non-malicious error that resulted in an overpayment to a beneficiary, why wouldn't we want to collect as a state, recover those funds so that they could be distributed to other beneficiaries?
And I will note, Representative Hudson, bringing it within the purview of child care operators, because of course that sector is very much within our jurisdiction. So kudos to you in terms of the structuring of that question. Representative Richardson, well, you can turn it to whoever you wish, but I'll start with you, I guess.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Hudson, for the question. So the foundation of this bill is currently modeled after what we have currently in state statute with our unemployment insurance program. So when we are looking at sort of the processes that relate to overpayment, this is what's happening right now from an unemployment context as well. And so just sort of understanding that sort of the rationale behind the construct, it's related to what we're doing currently.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's fascinating, perhaps alarming, the idea that you're saying that this is a model that is already being implemented in unemployment payments. So there would it be accurate to say then that there is no mechanism in place for the public to know whether or not there are overpayments being made that would indicate a lack of proper financial controls by the state?
Representative Richardson, if you know, we may be getting a little bit outside the scope of your knowledge, but
yeah.
Please, yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Hudson. So I think it would be really helpful to be able to have the department here to talk through the process. But what we have talked about in previous hearings is the reality that the state does have a process in place to collect overpayments, which includes using various tools for collections and including being able to levy garnishments and things of that nature. So that is what is happening right now in terms of the way that it's being utilized within the UI program.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to state, just to bring it back within the jurisdiction, that the reason why this is a concern is my understanding, and the author can correct me if I'm wrong, is that the payroll tax rate on both sides, the employer and the employee, is going to be adjusted in order to maintain the solvency of this fund. And so to the extent that we have overpayments that are not being recollected, that could have a direct impact upon the payroll taxes that are being paid by both child care providers and their employees.
Yeah, no, and the finance and the health of our child care providers are certainly a top importance to folks in this committee. So yeah, no dispute there. All done for now then, Representative Hudson. Okay, great, yeah, no problem. Anybody else has comments or questions at all? Representative Coulter, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I didn't want to get in the way of anyone asking questions. I'm gonna try and keep my comments brief, not only because we have a lot of work to do in this committee, but also because if I don't, I'm probably going to end up getting emotional. But I just really deeply want to thank you, Representative Richardson, and everyone for moving this bill forward. This is literally an issue that I ran on. This is a need in the state of Minnesota. This is a need for every child, every mom, every dad, every parent in the state of Minnesota. And we have learned, I think, in so many different ways over the last couple of years how true that is. And I know I'm personally so deeply grateful to have had paid family and medical leave when my kids were born, and I simply cannot imagine how I would have been a functioning person. I guess you could argue I'm not really now, but how I could have been a functioning person without that. So I am just deeply, deeply grateful that this is moving forward, and really, really proud to support it. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Coulter. Representative Bliss.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple of quick questions. I'm a small business owner myself, It's not child care, but I do have family members that do have a small child care operation. When my employee count goes from 0 to 3, just depending on what's going on. And I know in the child care arena, most family-run operations are one or two people. This bill provides up to 24 weeks of leave. And we all know that there's a workforce shortage out there. And if a child care provider is required to give 24 weeks of leave, has there been any thought or any studies as to what's that going to do to the availability of child care seats or vacancies, you know, ability to meet the demand of child care? I know we're having a child care crisis right now. We're trying to figure out ways to do it. I think this bill is only going to exacerbate that problem.
Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Bliss, for the questions. I think it's important to note that we have individuals who have paid family leave right now here in Minnesota, and we also have really good data on how people use leave. And what the data tells us is people use less leave than they typically have available to them. And the average sort of leave for those who currently have this benefit is about 6 weeks. I think it's also really important to understand that for organizations who are already providing this benefit, they're not seeing sort of this mass exodus of people that are taking advantage of the system. Overall, Minnesotans, we're hard workers, and we have a strong work ethic, and the data that has been collected shows that as well. You bring up a good point about the workforce shortage that we are experiencing. It's gotten worse under the COVID pandemic. There's a war on talent as well. And what we also see is that if we really want people to return to the workforce after giving birth, if they don't have access to paid family leave, they're less likely to return to the workforce, which only intensifies the already challenging situation that we find ourselves in from a workforce situation. And so as we're thinking about ways to sort of prioritize around it, this plan is really about pooling and sharing the costs to ensure that smaller employers can, in fact, offer this benefit. And nationally, we know that 78% of small businesses support this, and they know that the only way they're going to be able to get to it is if there is a publicly run program.
Representative Bliss.
Thank you. So I guess as a small business owner, I don't necessarily disagree with you that people are hard workers. The problem is I have a business to run. Mm-hmm. And if somebody takes the leave, right now they can take it without pay, but it's still going to impact what happens to my customers. So in doing that, I'm going to have to hire a second person if I have one employee to split the work. So we're going to go from 40 hours to 20 hours to cover my business and to ensure that I have the employees to run my business and provide the services that I'm providing to the public. I guess my concern is if you're going to put a payroll tax on that, on the average salary in Minnesota is roughly $300 a month on the average employee payroll tax. You're going to cut their working hours potentially on a small business like mine. That's what I would have to do. I don't see where it's going to pay the big dividends that you're saying now. And don't get me wrong, I've seen, you know, the struggle, the personal family issues. But I think we could maybe do a voluntary system, allow small businesses to function in the way that they can function and have a voluntary insurance, maybe subsidized by the state, something like that. So that's my comments. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Poise. Representative Richards, you had something you want to say in response to that briefly?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Poise, for your comments and bringing the perspective of small business owners to this discussion today. I think it's important to note that with this program, it would actually free up small business owners to be able to pay the wages to bring someone in if someone has a serious health condition. Because when we're talking about some of these serious health conditions, there are serious health conditions that would not allow someone to be continuing to work. We've heard stories about people with surgeries and cancers, and when people are out, they're out. And to your point, business still needs to be able to go on. And I also just want to note in terms of what the premiums would look like. So the state average right now for wages is $66,924 a year. And so looking at what that cost would be for an employer over the entire 12-month period, it could either be $468.47 for that year if they want to cover the full cost of that premium, or if they want to share the cost with the employee and only pay 50% of it, it would be $234.23 with the chargeback.
So I built in a little bit of extra time in the schedule, kind of anticipating some of this, but I'd like to be wrapping up relatively soon. We've got several folks to go before Lee Daniels and Richardson. So I'm going to go to Representative Katisa Witoon. We've got Representatives Lesnikar, Lee, and then we'll go to Lee Daniels. If we can all keep it pretty quick.
Representative Katisa Witoon. And thank you, Representative Richardson, for carrying the bill again. I'm a co-author. I have been a co-author in the past. I wanted to just touch on the importance of the opportunity of a universal program. I've shared with you previously at my last employer outside of the House of Representatives, I was in operations and administration for a medium-sized IT consulting company that was headquartered out of Missouri. And they didn't have a fully comprehensive paid family leave program, so there was actually like different divisions in it. And unfortunately for me, my husband and I had trouble getting pregnant, so we built our family initially through adoption, and there was no coverage for adoption in the paid family leave program from my employer if the child was not an infant. So because we opted to adopt out of the foster care system, all of our children were older than infant age, which was defined in the program as younger than 12 months. So I got no leave at all. The spouse of a pregnant person would get 1 week of leave if there was a new infant in the family, but also no leave for adoption or placement of a foster child or child greater than the age of 12 months. And then for the mother, if they had a vaginal birth, they were, I think, qualified for 8 weeks of paid leave. And then for folks who had a C-section, then they could qualify for short-term disability on top of that. So it in my eyes, it really kind of pit us employees against each other, because it was like, oh, well, you know, you can't get pregnant, we're not going to help you pay for your fertility treatments, and if you decide to have a more untraditional way of building your family, then we're not going to support you in bonding with those children. When I would argue, and we've already heard conversation from the Department of Human Services this year about how many children are waiting to find families and the support that we really need within that system. So it's a disincentive for people to adopt out of the foster care system, I think. It's and not having this this support from their employer. So I just wanted to share my personal experience in not receiving the support that I needed from my employer while they were giving, the mothers and parents down the hall at least some sort of help. So it was really frustrating, and I was able to take unpaid family and medical leave through the FMLA system. But if my husband hadn't received any family leave from his employer, I'm not really sure what we would have done during that time. So, thanks so much for bringing this forward.
Thanks for sharing that, Representative Giza-Witoon. Representative Zelesnikar.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you. I just have a couple questions. As this bill is written, it allows the employee and the employer to face a potential of 24 weeks in a calendar year for medical leave and family leave combined, as I understand it, which is half 50% of time. So to the question of replacement of shifts for nursing homes, assisted livings, hospitals, child care centers, police, schools, the list goes on. My question is, who's going to teach? Who's going to respond to the fire? We are in an employee shortage. So that's one question. And then my other question is, I may be older here and had my kids are 28 and 26, but even then I was able to have family medical leave in a format, and now we have it in statute that allows for 12 weeks. So I saved my vacation and my sick time so I would have paid time off. And I'm wondering, is the vacation and sick leave that people accrue in addition to this potential 24 weeks in a calendar year?
If they do, in fact, accrue that, but Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Zelesnikar, for the question. So I'll start with your question about vacation and PTO first, and Mr. Chair makes a really good point, because there are a lot of people who don't have access to that at all. And I think that this is a really key point of this. We have a safety net system that is not extending to people in the same way. So it's great when people have access to paid time off, but a lot of people don't have that as an opportunity. So the way that PTO would operate under this bill, a worker could decide to take PTO, but it's important to note that if someone is taking PTO, it doesn't result in protected leave. So when we think about, like, the Family Medical Leave Act that allows job protection while someone is sick, that is not a protection that is extended to PTO. And then to your question about the workforce shortage, we also know that a contributing factor to the workforce shortage is the fact that people don't have access to paid family and medical leave. And particularly within the childcare context, if you have a childcare center that doesn't accept children until 6 weeks, that becomes an issue that oftentimes leads to people leaving the workforce as a result of not being able to have a safe place for their child to go to. And I just really want to continue to push back on this narrative that Minnesotans are going to take 24 weeks of leave. First of all, this is not I've just decided I want to take 24 weeks of leave program. It requires that the person would meet the certification requirements and be approved for the program. And the data that we have within the state for people who have access to paid leave right now, they take about 6 weeks, which is far less than the 12 weeks that is an entitlement under the federal program.
Thank you, Representative Zelesnikar, and then we'll need to wrap up.
So if I understand this correct, it is possible for those who have PTO and vacation and sick leave to have 24 weeks in a calendar year plus whatever they've accrued and take that time off. There are many, you know, I've ran healthcare, and we've all done accrued benefits, and there's many places that do offer that. So I think the big scope of awareness has to be, what is the big picture for filling shifts? Because there will be services not available to all of us in the room when you can't get in to see the dentist, you can't get in to see the eye doctor, you can't get in to get an important appointment because there's just simply not an employee. This program isn't something that caring for people isn't the issue. There is a method right now with FMLA for 12 weeks to do that, to use for medical or family. And the language is very broad here. This is, if I have a friend, my best friend is like family to me in the description. Who defines that? That can qualify for the family leave side. So that, and that's typically things we've used for PTO and other things. That won't be the case now. So if I'm hearing you right, it is possible. Whether it's government employees or private employees, if we accrue vacation and PTO, we will have maybe 1 week, 4 weeks, 6 weeks, whatever people have, in addition to 24 weeks. It's possible.
Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the question. Again, going back to PTO, PTO would be within the discretion of the employer. So it would be up to the employer to decide that, because PTO is not a protected leave. And it's important to also note that the Family Medical Leave Act currently that provides 12 weeks, that's unpaid leave. So there isn't any paid leave that is associated with that. And that only applies to some employers as well. Not all employees have access to FMLA. So I think it's important to know the gaps and the carve outs. And what we are doing here with this bill, we're extending the safety net, because we know all workers, regardless of the title they have or where they work, at some point are going to face illness, or at some point are going to face a seriously ill family member, and they shouldn't be in a situation of where they're having to choose between a paycheck and caring for themselves or their loved one.
Thank you. So, Representative Lesnar, we really do need to keep moving, and somebody else is starting to add themselves to the list.
Yeah, I just had a follow-up. I mean, to my knowledge, there's not a fiscal note on this bill, so I just have very... I have big concerns on what the impact is of funding this on the program, but also the secondary impacts of what the reality will be. Yeah. It isn't the principle of, is this a great thing? It is, what are going to be the costs? Because without employers, there won't be the unemployed. This program can't be sustainable. So creating it is the easy part. Sustaining it is going to be the reality. And I just want to make sure we have all the data. Thank you.
No, thank you. And then good questions. We've got Representative Lee on the list, and I know I need to go to Lee Daniels and Representative Richardson, and we're already over time. Representative Nelson, I'm going to try to squeeze you in if I can. It's Representative Lee's turn, but I really want to keep moving. So Representative Lee, please.
Sure. And thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to thank Representative Richardson for bringing this really important bill before us. I want to offer my perspective as someone who runs a small business. Our team is small, and I run the financials. I think a universal program like this would actually help us afford to keep our employees. We've invested a lot in our folks, and we want them to stay, but we don't have the money to fund this ourselves, right? And so this universal program is actually a benefit that's really important for us to keep our team members who we care about, who we know have loved ones that they care about. And so thank you.
Thank you so much. Representative Nelson, we are way over. You got something real quick?
My apologies. And I think, you know, we've heard this in workforce, and I think one of the questions I've got, you know, we've got a child care center that maybe they operate in numerous states, and maybe you have an employee that maybe they work, maybe some in Minnesota and some in North Dakota or Wisconsin or something like this. How does that affect, you know, an employee that may be working in two, maybe they're in management and working in two centers? How does how does that work in being portable? Do they get credit in Minnesota only, or you know, what happens there?
And I do suspect Representative Richardson would be happy to have you sign on to a letter urging a federal paid family leave bill, which of course would absolutely address that. In the meantime, though, as long as that gets blocked, Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the question as well. I mean, especially in the shadow of the COVID pandemic, where a lot of people are working remotely, we're seeing a lot of people who are working outside of the state that pays their paycheck. And even before the pandemic, that is something that we've had to deal with in terms of the UI system as well. And so when employers are making the decision that they are going to allow employees to work across state lines, there are definitely laws and regulations that would require them to follow the appropriate legal requirements of that particular state. So in terms of how we address this right now within the UI program would be the way that this would be addressed for paid family medical leave.
We know different states have different laws and multi-state employers have to deal with them. So we'll have to save other questions for later. Lee Daniels, we're going to go to you as usual, and then Representative Richardson. Lee Daniels.
Thank you, Chair Pinto, and thanks for the leeway this morning. It's a big bill, big consequences, huge price tag, a lot of development, hundreds of new FTEs, and on and on and on. And I'm not sure that any small business could survive having potentially somebody out for, 24 weeks or more with what my colleague mentioned about PTO time added to that. I've been in the job force for, let's see, I'm 64. I started work when I was 8, full-time 17, so a long time. Anytime my career, about 45, 50 years, I never thought this would be something. And there are people, I've been both the employer and employee, there are people that will take advantage of every single day they can get off and not have to come to work. The vast majority are honest and they want to work, but they're out there. So just to, your data was maybe not 100% accurate. I have a question on, I read somewhere in the bill, and I was just trying to find it during the hearing here, that if somebody works for a company for 90 days, they qualify for, I believe, both the 12-week periods. Could you
just get that clarified, Representative Richardson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the question. So this would be a portable benefit. So if a person earns a sufficient amount of credits, they would be able to take this to their next employer as well. And so understanding that just as the UI system works on a credit system, this would also work on a credit system. And so if a person has a sufficient amount of credit, they would be eligible for the program. And I just want to clarify one thing. It's not my data. This is data that has been done by the University of Minnesota and other spaces as well. And I just want to ensure that we're giving credit to where it is due, because I didn't create the data. And we've heard a lot about the cost of this bill, but I just want to really urge members to think about the cost of not doing this bill, because there are costs that we are bearing every year as a state, including these costs related to care for preterm births. It's more than $371 million a year that we as a state are bearing. And that's just one small point. Long-term care. I mean, there are so many research pieces here that show ways we as a state could be saving money. Less reliance on public assistance. And so I think when we talk about the cost of doing this bill, we also need to talk about the cost of not doing that. And there are also real live costs in this as well. The infant mortality crisis that we have within the state, 350 infants dying a year, it doesn't have to be that way. Many of these deaths are preventable. Our maternal mortality crisis, we have the worst outcomes for maternal mortality and of all high wealth nations. I personally am not satisfied with continuing to allow people to die when it's preventable.
Thank you, Representative Richardson. Lee Daniels, all done from you? Something else?
I'm getting there.
You're getting there. Okay.
There's a lot of issues here.
Yeah.
The amount of testimony and letters that were sent in is just a fraction of it. I mean, there's got to be, 10 letters in support and the 4 or 5 letters that are
So we do have those. But yes, please.
Well, I just want to mention, first off, one of mine is my constituent at the Faribault Mills. It used to be the Woolen Mills, the oldest company in the state. And I've had the opportunity to tour it about four or five times. So last Friday, I got another tour. The letter is from Ross Widmoyer, and he explains in detail, you know, how this might affect his business. But I'll just give you the quick gist of it. They just invested $2.75 million in a new equipment, state-of-the-art dryer systems for the fabric, state-of-the-art washing systems for the fabric. These people have to be trained to know how to do that. These are multi-million dollar pieces of equipment. He said if one of those takes 12 weeks off, they have two options. They can either slow the production down or they'll have to stop. So he says this puts us in a bad predicament. They've actually hired 20 new employees since COVID ended. So, you know, in the very, you know, recent. So this will really affect their business. They will be forced to maybe lay off people instead of hire more. And they do contracts. Just so you know, they do contracts with the Army, the Navy, the Air Force. And every blanket that they make, there's another blanket donated to the shelters. This is a company we want in Minnesota. So just kind of go over that. And then I'll leave it to this, the last thing. Is there a physical note on this yet, Chair Pinto?
Representative Daniels, I'm not sure, but it's not in our jurisdiction. I mean, I'm not sure if Mr. Berg, please.
Mr. Chair, members, there is a physical note pending. It's been referred out to quite a number of agencies. I looked yesterday afternoon. There were maybe, I don't know, about 10 agencies that have completed their sections. There are several that haven't, so it's not, the note itself is not fully complete yet.
Can I ask, there was a physical note from last year or 2 years ago. I believe it was like $1.7 billion. Does that sound familiar? I'm sorry.
I'm not sure these are fiscal analysts who have the expertise in this. Ms. Bechtel, you?
Mr. Chair and Representative Solvay Bechtel, House Fiscal, the fiscal note from years past was broken up into general fund appropriations and then family and medical leave benefit account revenue and appropriations. I believe you have something there with the revenue in and then potential revenue out for the family and medical leave account predictions for usage.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Richardson, please. Yeah. Oh, I
because
you. I'm so sorry.
No, it's okay. The $1.7 billion that was referenced, that was actually what we were identifying as part of the surplus to shore up the fund.
And I should note, Lee Daniels, again, so this is not in our fiscal jurisdiction at all. We're nearly double the time we were going to spend on this that I'd specifically allocated. So this bill is going to be in a lot more committees, and it will be on the floor as well. So any final point from you, Lee Daniels?
Or? One final question for you, Chair.
Yeah.
Since we don't have a physical note yet, and we are, that's part of our title in the committee, I would move to lay the bill on the table pending the conclusion of the fiscal note.
Okay. Representative Daniels has moved to lay the bill on the table. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed?
Aye.
No. The motion fails. Lee Daniels, anything further?
No, I do again appreciate your willingness to extend the time.
Thank you.
This is a huge thing, and we need to, you know, make sure we get it right, and it can't be just rushed through. And I feel like that, I said last session, the last committee, things are getting pushed through really fast, and I would appreciate if we could control the speed a little bit.
Yeah, thank you so much, Lee Daniels. As I turn to Representative Richard for final comments, perhaps you could just note, if you even have them in your head, Representative Richardson, the sheer number of committees this is passing through. And I'll just note, Canada, 12 months of paid leave. You go right across the border from Niagara Falls, 12 months. Their small businesses are doing just fine. Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That is correct. It's going through a number of committees, and this is also, I think, marking year three of me carrying this bill, and even before I got to the State House, I think this bill has been around for 7-8 years now, and so it's been a conversation that we've been having at the Capitol for a number of years now.
Okay, good. And I do know many committees stops, even a number yet to come. So members, I suspect you'll be seeing this in those committees and be focused on the jurisdiction there. And I'll have plenty of comments, but I'll save them for the floor, and I think a lot of other members will probably want to do the same in support of this bill. With that, Representative Keeler renews her motion that House File 2, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Labor and Industry. All in favor of that motion, please say aye. Aye. All opposed?
No.
Okay. The ayes have it. The motion passes. And House File 2, as amended, is re-referred to the Committee on Labor and Industry. Representative Richardson, thank you so much for your work. Thanks to the testifiers. Appreciate it. Representative Katiza Watumer, I could have you head up to the front if you can. And as you do, Representative Katiza Watumer moves that House File 570 be brought before the committee. And this is a bill, members, that this is within our jurisdiction. So this one's going to be laid over, because that's what we're doing with these spending bills within our jurisdiction. So we'll be doing that. So Representative Katiza Watumer, so glad to have you. Please describe House File 570.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I think we can go through this pretty quickly. Every day is a great day to talk about how we can support Minnesota's littlest learners and their families. And today I am especially excited to discuss a wonderful early childhood literacy program called Reach Out and Read. If you're not familiar with the amazing work that they do across the state and across the country, I'm privileged to be able to share. Reach Out and Read partners with clinics and pediatricians throughout Minnesota and assists them in implementing a literacy program that provides books to children between the ages of 6 months and 5 years at their regular well checks. According to the American Academy of Pediatrics, Reach Out and Read is the most studied and scaled prevention program, which seeks to prevent gaps in readiness as they and before they emerge. So House File 570 would appropriate a $500,000 grant to Reach Out and Read Minnesota through the Minnesota Department of Education. I will allow my testifier to speak more in detail about the program expansion and the great work that they've done in partnership with the state over the past few years and their future goals as an organization. But I just want to speak very briefly on our focus here in this committee. We've been doing this work now together, Mr. Chair, in our previous committee, but we continue to hear that the first few years of a child's life are critical in brain development. Members may also be familiar with the million-word gap, or the difference between a child who has been read 5 books a day until they're 5 years old versus a child who has never been read to, just the difference in number of words in their vocabulary or that exposure. Well, based on calculations done from the Crane Center for Early Childhood Research and Policy at the Ohio State University, here's how many words a child would have heard by the time they were 5 years old. If they're never read to, they've probably only heard 4,662 words. 1 to 2 times a week they were read to, that jumps to 63,570 words. If you read 3 to 5 times a week together, goes up to 169,520 words. Daily is almost 300,000 words. And if you read 5 books a day to your child, they will have been exposed to almost 1.5 million words. So it quickly becomes an equity issue and ties directly into the long-reaching opportunity gaps that we have here in Minnesota, some of the worst in the nation. If families aren't able to build a home library, if parents are working multiple jobs or unable to procure books in their native language, if children don't see their caregivers modeling how to read, they may not have that chance to read independently or the opportunity of learning to read for pleasure. Reach Out and Read doctors are able to introduce a book and share with the child and their caregiver how to read, how to interact with that book, to turn the pages, to look at the pictures, and encourage them to read together daily at home. I enthusiastically support this program both as a legislator and as a parent. My children's eyes light up every time they visit our family doctor, and she has written little notes inside the covers to them. So it's been
amazing for my kids, and I know so many children across the state benefit from this program. So now I would like to introduce Kristen Hopland, who's the Executive Director of Reach Out and Read Minnesota, to share more about how our support for this program directly impacts children and families across the state.
Thank you so much. Kristen Hopland, welcome. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Yes, thank you, Chair Pinto, and thank you to Representative Cotiza Watun for her authorship of this bill. I am Chris Hopland. I'm the Executive Director of Reach Out and Read Minnesota. I'm humbled to represent this program, which is the product of the hard work and dedication to supporting young children and their families from both our team and the thousands of healthcare workers and clinic staff across Minnesota. I'm testifying today because I know our program is effective, and with the state's continued support, we can continue making smart, cost-effective investments in Minnesota's youngest families that will resonate for years to come. Our program model is supported by dozens of peer-reviewed studies. At every well-child visit, from infancy through age 5, clinicians trained in our program provide a book and early developmental guidance to young children and their families. Providers use the book as a launch pad to connect with families on a deeper level and assess cognitive and social-emotional development, and to coach families on how best to support their child in this critical period of rapid growth. One of the great benefits of partnering with doctors is that they do appreciate research-backed approaches. It's because of our large body of research that we know how effective our program is. We know that families who participate read more often together in their homes, visit their local libraries more frequently, and are more likely to cite reading together as a favorite activity. We know that children's expressive and receptive language scores increase. One study in an underserved community showed language growth of 3 to 6 months among participating children. And finally, we know that participating clinics see higher rates of attendance at their well-child visits, and our program improves trust between healthcare providers and families. The American Academy of Pediatrics has endorsed Reach Out and Read and cited it as the most studied and scaled primary prevention program, which seeks to prevent gaps before they emerge. We want these results for every child in Minnesota, particularly those growing up in our most underserved communities. With the state's support, we can ensure that thousands of families across the state are getting high-quality books in their hands, along with the best evidence-based guidance for helping their children learn and grow. And thank you, Chair Pinto. I also have a written testimony from our medical director, Dr. Gigi Chawla, which I could read or...
Yeah, typically not. I mean, how long is it? Yeah, if it's like maybe a paragraph, but I'm guessing it's probably a pretty lengthy thing. Yeah.
Mr. Chair, is that in members' packets? Or
yeah, I'm not sure that one is, though, so we will get that out.
We can email it out. Okay,
yeah.
Thank you. Okay.
Yeah, thank you. Good, but I know Dr. Chawla does amazing work, of course. Good. Thank you. So are there any public testifiers to this bill, House File 570? There is a letter in the packet and also a two-page sheet. I'm at a letter from the Minnesota chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics and also Children's Minnesota. So seeing nobody come down for public testimony, up for member questions or comments. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. And, reading to my children has been one of the fun thing at bedtime. And, they pick out their favorite books, and I've been known to start falling asleep while reading, and they will quickly nudge me and, "Dad, that's not how the story goes," and correct me on Winnie the Pooh doing something or whatever it is, I think reading is important. It's a bonding time, and it's also this science shows the understanding of the words they've heard, and I'm just wondering, does and probably for Ms.
Hopland.
How big is your organization? Does it work with all clinics, or what? If you can kind of give a little bit. Size of it.
A little more context. Actually, I do feel like that's helpful because it is expanding. And if you can just provide a little more context.
Absolutely. Thank you, Representative, for the question. We are in 306 clinics right now in Minnesota. So probably most, if not all of you, have a clinic in participating in your district. This would be continued state funding. And one of the things that that we've been doing so far with our state funding is to expand in greater Minnesota. We were very metro heavy with clinics being involved, and we really wanted to and had reason to expand in greater Minnesota. And so we've used that state funding to bring on new clinics, purchasing books for clinics while we find sustainable funding for them in their local communities. And so we've grown, even throughout the pandemic, we've grown quite a bit. So that's our hope, is to continue. I think the language in the bill states that, you know, with continued support by 2030, that we would be in every clinic in Minnesota, serving every family in Minnesota. Right now, we're at about half.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you for that. And, you know, I just wanted to, you know, make sure that we were, you know, it was going to outstate clinics. I know that clinics and doctor's office all across the state have different reading programs. Some of them are, you know, through just the philanthropy of the community of coming in and making sure that there's books available for children to read. And you know, I just, I don't know if I have a whole lot more comment than that, but, you know, I know that, you know, local, you know, there's a whole lot of local philanthropists that are helping out with, you know, making sure books are available and you know, partnering with that as well. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Nelson. Representative Lesnick.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you. I concur that reading is critical, and I've been visiting schools and see many partnerships with nonprofits and different organizations that have been fostering this success too. What I'm concerned about is the report that came out today on the oversight of state-funded grants to nonprofit organizations. And so it is signaling to us accountability and oversight. So for me as a representative, I have concerns that we have systems and that we address what this report says before we add to that. And I just ask that we take some time to look at these recommendations before we add more programs. And there may be other ways to get reading at the local level. So I just encourage us to look at, to make sure, I want to make sure that we are responsibly having money go where it needs to go. We have systems at a state level, like we would in any home or business, that money is well spent. And so as I'm just looking at it now because it just came up. So that just was released today.
Can you say, Representative Lesnick, pardon me, the recommendations you're referring to, what is that report? I think I may have just missed that.
It's oversight of state-funded grants to nonprofit organizations, February 2nd, 2023.
The legislative auditor
report? Yes, legislative auditor report. And it's talking about the many recommendations it's saying is that the Minnesota Department of Education has established grants, but we have under review only partially compiled that they are recommending that the grant management procedures provide more specific direction. And they have guidelines here asking us as state officials to take action on X, so Y doesn't happen. And I think we have a responsibility to look at that as we increase funding. I'm all for reading, but I want to make sure it's happening in the appropriate way. Thank you.
Well, thank you. And I should note again, this is just being laid over. Then we'll have our budget discussion coming up, you know, into March. So we should have some time. And I certainly would encourage members, and I guess apparently me too, to review that. So, yeah, thanks. I'm not sure if Representative Katizu-Witun or Ms. Hoppin wants to say anything regarding that, and no problem. If not, I'll have a few questions. But, yeah, so we'll be looking at that. Can you just remind me and maybe inform members? So I think we first got funding for Reach Out and Read, state funding, when again? Maybe that's just one question. If you can, Ms. Hoppin.
The first year we received funding was 2019, and then funding was continued through ARPA.
Okay. And the amount again, Ms. Hoppin?
Currently, we are receiving $75,000 per year.
And under the bill, this would be the $250,000. If this was enacted, it would be the $250,000. I think it would go into the base. So this would then be state funding to fund the program going statewide by 2030. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, good. I'm just seeing if there's other questions or comments from anybody. When I've seen this presentation before, the talk that I don't know if you use this phrase, but you know, if you give us the books, because essentially maybe you can talk about what this money is paying for. What I've always heard is if you give us the books, we'll toss the doctors in for free. But if you could just explain that a little bit more about what are we buying if this were to, with this money?
Sure. Thank you, Chair Pinto. Absolutely. So a few things. We've used this funding to support the growth, like I said, almost exclusively in greater Minnesota. What we do is we work with clinics who many of who are clamoring to come on, and we purchase the first year of their books for them. And then we take that time, which can be, we do have very low-cost books, but, you know, several thousand dollars. We're taking that time to work with clinic staff, leadership, healthcare management, and look at and see where the sustainable funding can come in, because we don't want them to just do the program for a year. We want it to be sustainable. So sometimes that comes through their operating budget. Sometimes that comes from, others have mentioned, local philanthropy, local community groups, civic groups. And so that's primarily what we've been using funding. We're also using state funding to help us support clinics by going out in person, visiting clinics, training the doctors, all of the doctors involved taking accredited training, training clinic staff in the model, and making sure clinics have everything they need and books that are in the languages that they need and that are culturally and developmentally appropriate.
Okay, good. Anything further from members at all? Okay, so Representative Hicks, yeah.
Thank you so much for coming. I'm so excited about this program. I do just want to address the grants situation, because I was also, you know, looking at the report. And as someone who has been a part of grants conversations, I do want to just, like, highlight that if you go to the recommendation section, the cusp of the report is that three people in state government are responsible for the grants management component. And so I hear a lot of times in this committee and in other committees and in this body as a whole about oversight. And yet when we start talking about the people needed to do the oversight is then when I start hearing things about adding FTEs. And so I just kind of want to go on the record as saying those two things must happen simultaneously. There is not a way to talk about oversight without talking about FTEs. So I just sort of wanted to throw that out there today, because there's been you know, talked about quite a bit, and I don't understand how we can pull apart the two things and not talk about them together.
All right, thank you. Thank you, Representative Hicks. Representative Zelizdekar, back to you. Yeah.
Thank you, Chair. And I totally agree. I understand that question. I guess for me, looking at government's role with technology and systems in place, grants aren't a new thing, and there are a lot of grants that have been, awarded to very legitimate sources, and we've had great outcomes. I do think that there should be systems in place after all these years to assure that there can be efficiencies, even if we have three FTEs, because that's the same thing we're held to in other standards with mandates in the state, in all the industries. So we need to make sure that we're looking at that, it's vetted, and that the systems are running, because this isn't something new. Every 2 years, we have grants that are going to be awarded. So the processes and the system should be in place. And before we add, it's like before you build more buildings, you make sure you have the first couple buildings solid. So if we have grants that are out right now, we should make sure we have systems that have accountability for it. And then we add to it. Otherwise, it's not reasonable to think we would have a good outcome. And so thank you.
Thank you, Representative Lesnikar. And I guess I might urge all of us, you know, we know that there are needs that the people in the state have. It's our job to help meet those, to do so in a responsible way. We're going to be making budgeting decisions over the next couple months. And so I don't think it'll be a good, I would argue it wouldn't be a good result for us to just, you know, not do anything this session, of course. We're going to be doing things. And so I think in the coming weeks, let's be diving into that report, other things, and thinking about how we can be making good decisions in the next couple months to make sure we are meeting needs and making sure we're doing so in the very best way possible. So that'll be important for us to do over the coming weeks. I'll see anybody else. So Lee Daniels, go to you, and then the bill's author. Lee Daniels.
Thank you, Chair Pinto. And I agree with you on laying the bill over. That'll give the OLA time to spend in looking for those pervasive things that we were mentioning by Representative Zelizdekar. So just give us more time to get into that and see what recommendations they have, and a lot of it was pointed back at the legislature, that the legislature to, you know, do that. Thank you for laying it over on the table, and hopefully we can have more information at our next meeting on this bill.
Thank you so much. So Representative Cotizza-Batoon, we'll close with you, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to be clear, laying the bill over was the plan. This is in this committee's jurisdiction, and money would be coming out of our budget for this bill. So we're not laying it over because there's anything wrong with this bill or this program.
Yes.
And we're going to be making decisions on this program and many other programs as we complete our committee budget recommendations. I think that something really important to consider is that this program meets families where they are. They're already going to their well-child visits, and it's not an extra step of their day. It's not an extra trip that they have to make. It's something that is already a part of the wellness of their child and their family. So I think that making sure that children and families all across the state have access to a clinic in their area, and like Ms. Hopland detailed, we have been expanding in, throughout greater Minnesota. I think that that's something that's very important, and I would appreciate the support of the committee as we go forward and make our budget decisions.
Thank you, Representative Katiza-Witoon. Yeah, it is unfortunate that timing happened to be when that report came out. I have to say, I just, it's hard for me to think of a more impactful $75,000 that the state has been spending. Thinking about the power of that book in the pediatrician's hands and all the different things that can be done and is done in the room with the family, and then when the book is brought home, really, really powerful. So this is a wonderful, wonderful program. Thank you so much to you, Ms. Hopland. Please thank the many physicians involved as well. And with that, the chair does lay over House File 570 for possible inclusion in the budget bill. So members, here's the plan. There's a Minnesota Kids Count book. Again, I've referred to this in the last hearing. I'm going to refer to it again. Please make sure to hang on to it, put it in your save folder, or I'll ask the pages again to please keep it. I'm in touch with Deborah Fitzpatrick, who was in the first presented with HF2 and was going to do the presentation. I think what we're going to do is we're going to hold that off yet again. But I urge you to take a look at it if you get a chance in the meantime. There's a lot of data. We've talked about data. This is a lot of important data about the welfare of kids in our state, which is so important. Members, I'm expecting that on Tuesday we'll be, and hoping we'll be receiving a presentation about the Great Start for All Minnesota Children Task Force, which was established a couple years ago and helping us to put together a path towards affordable, high-quality early care and learning that pays decent wages to people doing the work. So looking forward to that. Thank you so much. You've got an extra 9 minutes here in your morning. And with that, this meeting is adjourned.